This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Today we bring you an interview with former Detroit Mayor Dennis Archer. His autobiography is called Let the Future Begin. It tells the story of Archer's political career as well as his youth growing up in Cassopolis. Archer graduated from Western Michigan University and now has a dorm named after him on campus. He arrived at Western to begin his college education in an old Studebaker.
But I got there and the car died, and I kept getting tickets on the car because I couldn't move it.
Right.
I contacted the police department, campus police, and said, look, my car died. I can't move it. Can we do each other a favor? You all turn it in, get whatever money you can for turning it in or for whatever you might do, and you all forgive me on the tickets, which they did.
Cinta A-Stars interviewed Dennis Archer, a segment originally aired on WMUK's Between the Lines in January.
So you see, right there at the beginning, that wonderful gift for negotiation and turning a bad situation into something wonderful. That story that you just told is just one of many, many stories that are in your new book called Let the Future Begin. And I wanted to talk to you about that, your autobiography. Why don't we go back to what prompted you to write it? What's that message that you really want to convey to the readers of this book?
What prompted me to write it was my wife of long standing. She was the one who encouraged me to go to law school. And ultimately I did and fell in love with the law. And then I did the smartest thing I think I've ever done in my life. I married the teacher who suggested I go to law school. And so
there's always that good woman behind the man.
Listen, in this case, she was ahead of me. I was just fortunate. In any event, she encouraged me to go to law school, and so I did. And after having had the privilege of practicing law and having the privilege of being presidents of different bar associations, serving on the Supreme Court, and then really privileged to be mayor of the city of Detroit for two terms before I decided I wouldn't run again. She encouraged me to write a book so that our grandchildren, we have two grandsons, they're 9 and 12, would be able to appreciate what I tried to do with my life, and that I could also share with the public what I did while growing up and going to school and having been mayor. Because as she pointed out, you've had the benefit of the press writing about you, but they wrote about what they saw and what they felt was important. But if you write this book, you'll be able to leave a legacy for your grandchildren. And there are a lot of things that, as I thought about it, our two sons, adult sons, did not know about me. That I told them a lot about me, but, you know, you don't, there's some things you either inadvertently leave out or whatever, and I wanted them to know. And so that's what motivated me to write it. And as I wrote it, it occurred to me that I thought that young people would see how I grew up, having been born in Detroit and 5 years of age, moving to Cassopolis, population 1,200 people, great community. We did not have running water. And so we had an outhouse, and we had a honey pot that we used at night. I mean, there was a lot of... We didn't have running water. I took a bath in a metal tub every Saturday night.
Yeah, the book begins with this story of poverty. And I was intrigued, too, that your father sent your mother when she was about to give birth to Detroit so that she would have a hospital. And you didn't see your father for those first years.
No, I didn't. And he was very thoughtful and very concerned because in Cassopolis, we didn't have a hospital. Still don't have a hospital. Doctor, we don't have a hospital. Niles, Michigan, that's 14 miles away. South Bend, Indiana, is a distance 24 miles away from Cassopolis. And my dad didn't have a car. And so, you know, you never can tell when somebody is, your wife is going to have her water break and need to go to the hospital for potential delivery.
Mm-hmm.
And so he just felt that it would be wise to have me born in a hospital. And so my grandmother, and which was my mother's mother and her sister and three brothers, had already moved to Detroit. And so we were sent to Detroit, and I was born in Dorothy Rogers Hospital in Detroit, and I lived there for 5 years, and then returned to Cassopolis and mm-hmm. met my dad for the first time. My mom and everybody told me about my dad mm-hmm. and how he was concerned about all of us, loved us, cared about us, etc. And I was excited to meet him, and he turned out to be just an outstanding father who taught me a lot.
Yeah. So paint for our listeners a picture of Detroit back in those years, those first years that you were living there. What it was like for an African American.
Well, I will make this observation. At that time, I was born January 1st, 1942. The following year, 1943, Detroit had a real race riot. Mm-hmm. A riot that was started based upon race and racism. It was whites against blacks, blacks against whites, and about 43 people were killed, but the population continued to grow. Population of the city of Detroit grew to about 1.9 million people at its high point in 1953-54 before people started moving outside of the city and wanting to be where it was quiet, I guess, to hear the cows moo and the chickens crow or whatever. They moved out and started to move out. In Detroit, when I was growing up the first 5 years of my life, I'd go downtown with my grandmother or my mother, and it was people all over everywhere, and businesses downtown, and we would go to the Verner's soft drink mm-hmm. facility and get vanilla ice cream and Verner's pop. We would go to Kresge Five and Dime, and my mother would go down, grandmother would go down the basement and would buy chicken wings, for example, which mm-hmm. was about maybe 7 or 10 cents a pound. And we walked back home. She was an outstanding cook. And I just remember doing those kinds of things and going down and looking at Christmas time and looking in the windows, et cetera, mm-hmm. during the first 5 years of my life. It was just, I mean, it's people all over. And then when I moved to Cassopolis, with a population of 1,200 people, there was a distinguishing difference. When we got out of the car, it was just like it was silence because you wouldn't hear the traffic and you wouldn't hear the noise and the culture and the vibrancy of a large city. Mm-hmm. And yet that's where, while it started for me at an early age, that's where I really was taught values and by my mom and dad and my grandmother. And mother had done it, started it already when we were in Detroit. My mother was taught me my numbers and my colors before I started kindergarten in Detroit. But when I moved to Cassopolis, they wanted to start me in kindergarten again. And my mother said, no way, he's going to start in the first grade. They acquiesced. And they made it very clear. My dad had a third grade education. He lost his arm just above his left elbow in a car accident before I was born. And they didn't have what we have today, like Americans with Disabilities Act. And it was hard for him to find a job. So he worked for a gentleman by the name of Floyd Westcott, who winter home was in Sarasota, Florida, and his summer home was on Diamond Lake in Cassopolis, Michigan. He owned a tool and die shop in South Bend, Indiana, and my dad took care of his summer home in Cassopolis. My mother had a high school diploma, which was the norm back then in the day, but they made it very clear to me. As long as I can remember, they made it very, very clear to me that I was going to go to college.
When you went to school, and as you said, your parents both really encouraged you to go on and for higher institutions of education, and you became a teacher for disabled students. I can imagine what you taught them. What did they teach you?
Well, it helped me appreciate patience, which is what is needed, I think, for anyone to teach. But clearly, if you're working with learning disabled students, it's awfully important to have the patience to work with the students that we are privileged to teach and work with. And so I would leave school, go home, change clothes, because at the time when I was teaching, I'd either wear slacks, sport jacket, tie, or a suit, or tie, etc. I'd go home and change, put on jeans or khakis or something, come back to the school, and I might get involved in a pickup game of softball or something, or I'd stop by the homes of some of my students to talk with the parents to let them know what they could do at home to best help our students or their children. And so I enjoyed that. The principal, Violet Vardy, I taught at a bunch of elementary schools, suggested that I ought to consider being a principal because I got along so well with the students and with my fellow teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, but you're going to have to get a master's degree in education. And I started taking two classes down at the Rackham Building, which is where the University of Michigan taught its master's classes before you moved on and had to go on campus in Ann Arbor. But the two books that I used were the same two books that I used at Western Michigan University. And so I was sharing this with the teacher I was dating and saying, I don't know, why are we using these books? These are the same books that I used when I was at Western. And she then started talking, why don't you think about going to law school?
Mm.
And I said, I don't know anything about being a lawyer. I've never been in a lawyer's office. I don't know what they do, et cetera. The more I whined, or I should say complained, perhaps whined, about taking the classes, the more she suggested that I ought to think about going to law school. So I took the law school admissions test, got a score that suggested that if I applied myself and worked hard in school, that I had a chance to graduate from law school. I knew that if I graduated from law school, I'd have to take what is called the bar exam.
Yeah.
And I have to be able to pass the bar exam before I practice law. Nobody could guarantee you that any of this would be done, but it was an opportunity. And so I seized upon it, went to law school, and was able to graduate and pass the bar the first time and start practicing law.
And as you became a lawyer, as you write in the book, you begin to see that there are so few African-American lawyers out there. And that seems to become part of your mission as you progress as a lawyer to pull in other African-Americans into the profession. Maybe you can talk about that.
Sure. At the time, the difference between being a African-American lawyer or another African-American profession, well, an African-American physician was assured to have a patient base. An African-American teacher was assured to have an opportunity to teach, whether it happened to be in a segregated school or whatever, you could still practice your profession. But to be a lawyer, the lawyers were not, for example, the American Bar Association would not allow anybody even to apply to become a member until about 1943, when they changed their applications, which back in 1908, they changed to require you to list your ethnicity on the application to become a member. And if lawyers in that community did not recognize the name, they would go by the office where one was practicing law to make sure that you were not a person of color. And so that did not bode well for encouraging people of color, of blacks, to go to law school.
Mm.
And so there were very few of us. And today, for example, we are still underrepresented. About 10.4% of us are lawyers of color today. That's African-American, that's Hispanics, Asians, Middle Eastern, et cetera, people from India. I mean, we are still underrepresented today. And so I observed that when I was in law school. And in fact, when I was in law school and I started in the spring semester of 1966, there were very, very few women of any color in my law school class. And that was the same across the country. Today, fortunately, there's been a dramatic change, and women represent today at or more than 50% of the students going to law school. And so a lot of things have changed. But for those of us of color, we still have to make sure that we are encouraging young people at an early age, 7th, 8th, 9th grade, to start thinking about law school, to share with them what lawyers of color, and in particular African Americans, have done to help society and what has been done by lawyers, such as at the time when I grew up, I knew about a Thurgood Marshall because of what he did and what was done at Harvard, at Howard University, with the lawyers who went to law school there.
And you made it all the way to Associate Justice of Michigan's Supreme Court, a wonderful accomplishment.
It was a real wonderful opportunity to serve, and I felt very privileged. The first person of color to serve on our Michigan Supreme Court was Otis Smith. He had had other offices within the state, but he was appointed to serve on our Michigan Supreme Court. He was, when he was seeking election to return to the Michigan Supreme Court, he was defeated by Thomas Brennan, who was a Wayne County Circuit Court judge and went on to start the Thomas Cooley Law School after he resigned from the bench. And so it had been a 20-year absence of not having a person of color on the Michigan Supreme Court when Governor James Blanchard nominated me in, or appointed me in 1985, and to take the seat of Mr. Justice James Ryan when he was elevated to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, which took place in January of 1986. That's when I was sworn in January of 1986 and became a member of the 7-member Michigan Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is an awesome responsibility. Mm-hmm. It is rare to find a person appointed to or running from the practice of law to serve on the court, or being appointed as a trial lawyer to serve on the Michigan Supreme Court. Most people arrive there because they've served as a judge in other courts, whether it's circuit court, probate court, or the Court of Appeals.
And then you make a decision, as you're an associate justice, to run for mayor of Detroit and eventually becoming the 59th mayor for 2 terms. How did you make that decision? And I'm fascinated, too, to hear you talk about what you write about in your book, Thoughts for a Greater Detroit. You had a unique approach to campaigning.
I had been encouraged, and people had talked to me right after I got elected to retain my seat on the Supreme Court, that I ought to think about running for mayor. Well, Coleman Young was our mayor and had been mayor at that point. He was just been elected to his 5th term. Mm-hmm. And there were some issues that were occurring related to the city. Businesses were moving outside of the city. People were not investing in the city. We were starting to experience, because of the economy and the need to reduce the deficit and the like, the crime was rising. It was reported in the newspapers kids were being injured or killed over jackets, gym shoes, designer sunglasses, etc. Mm-hmm. Businesses were in, we had a lot of storefronts that were closed and boarded up, and we had people leaving the city, and they've been leaving the city since 1954.
Yeah.
We had a population just over 1 million people, according to the 1990 census, and we're 1,027,000, and we got that, frankly, because the Census Department had originally came in with a number, I think, in the 900,000 range, and Mayor Young would not accept that, so he put his appointees out and others and volunteers to demonstrate that we had more. So the Census Department originally said, or ultimately said, okay, population city of Detroit is 1,027,000. But it also reported that the city of Detroit had the highest percentage of people living below poverty. It was 32.2%. Mm-hmm. When you factored in the number of children who live below poverty, the number of children who lived in households living below poverty was about 46.6%. Mm. People needed jobs. They needed to find jobs because the jobs had moved outside of the city of Detroit. And people who were working outside, those who did not own cars or couldn't connect with a neighbor who or someone who was driving to where the job was, they'd have to take two or three buses to get there. And so there was a lot of concern. And so I started thinking about that. And what sort of motivated me were a couple of things. I didn't know it. First of all, Mayor Young was someone that I admired and respected. Mayor Young was someone whose campaign for his first reelection in 1977, I was privileged to be his campaign manager working under Robert Millender, who was the campaign director. And so I had a high regard for him, but I was troubled by what I was seeing in the city as I drove around. And so when Governor Blanchard lost his election to then State Majority Leader John Engler, I then went to Governor Blanchard and said, look, I'm thinking about running for mayor. And according to state statute, I've got to resign 1 year before the primary of the office that I was going to seek outside of the judiciary. And if I resign, I'd love for you to please consider appointing a person of color to take my place, because I don't want us to be without representation on the court, because that court is so important. He said he'd do it. Mm-hmm. And I resigned, and he appointed Conrad Mallett.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. We're bringing you an interview with former Detroit Mayor Dennis Archer. His autobiography is called Let the Future Begin. Cinta A-Stars interviewed Dennis Archer, a segment originally aired on WMUK's Between the Lines in January. After stepping down from the Michigan Supreme Court, Archer put together a detailed plan for Detroit. He says that included input from city residents.
And so when I announced, I was very fortunate to have Congressman George Crockett, whose campaign I ran for Congress to take Charles Diggs' spot, who resigned from office, and there was a special election. In any event, he had represented Mayor Coleman Young when Coleman Young was very active in the labor movement. He was called before the House Committee on Un-American Activities. George Crockett represented him there, did an outstanding job, and Coleman Young was just outstanding in terms of his testimony before the House Committee. And ultimately, before he became congressman, George Crockett was the corporation counsel for the city of Detroit at the request of Mayor Young. So there's that, all of that kind of synergy. And so when I announced my candidacy in November of 92, George Crockett came and said that he was supporting my candidacy and called upon Mayor Young to support me.
But he didn't, did he?
No, he didn't. He supported in the primary the chairman of the Wayne County Board of Commissioners, Art Blackwell. Mm-hmm. And when he lost in the primary and I won, the person who came in second, I had 53% of the vote when I came in second, or I came in first, Sharon McPhail came in second, and he supported her. And so it was on.
Yeah.
And I worked as hard as I could work. Nobody outworked me. I know that. We had over 6,000 volunteers who believed in Thoughts for a Greater Detroit and what we could do and accomplish. And when we won and the transition team was getting things, they were going through and working with the various departments of the city to learn what each needed, et cetera, and where each stood. Jay Alex, who was on the transition team, went to visit with the finance director of the city of Detroit and found that we were going to inherit an $88.5 million deficit. I have all these plans that we wanted to put in place, and we're going to inherit an $88.5 million deficit. We went to New York together. He was brilliant. He was able to help me navigate to work with Moody's and Standard & Poor's, which already had us at non-investment grades on our bonds, and the city had to buy insurance to sell our bonds in order to get things done within the city. He helped me work through, and we balanced the end of his budget, and I had a balanced budget every year that I was in office. Mm. I had a modest rainy day fund. I had a modest surplus. And at one point, newspapers wrote that the two pension funds, because of the economy that had been so great, with President Clinton and his administration, we were overfunded in our pension funds for police and fire and for our general employees. And so it was an interesting start, and we were very fortunate to have things come together.
I don't know if it's fortunate so much as, for one thing, you have a wonderful ability to pull together an enthused team of committed people. And this wasn't just administration. It was the community of Detroit. In your inaugural address, in fact, you asked everyone to get out there and sweep your sidewalk, clean your alleys, pick up trash. In other words, we're all in this together. And you yourself, in an effort called Detroit Clean Sweep, you got into coveralls and did some garbage cleaning up yourself.
I did. I will tell you, one of the things that I've learned a long time ago, I wouldn't ask anything. I wouldn't ask anybody to do anything I would not do myself.
Yeah.
Therefore, I felt it was absolutely important that I get out there. So I had a white coveralls that I wore and a baseball cap, and I would be out picking up trash, et cetera, just like everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
My staff got on me and said, why are you doing that? I'm doing it. Our community in the city of Detroit is just a fabulous community. We had, on Clean Sweep, we started out, I think, the first year with maybe about 7,500 people or maybe a little bit more. And the last year that I was in office, we had over 50,000 people on Clean Sweep. And that 50,000 people also included school children who cleaned up around their schools. The first year, we cleaned up around the schools, the volunteers and the like. We did city parks and cleaned that up, picked up trash so the kids could play in the park and be able to do so and to enjoy. And so we had strong community involvement. After my first year in office, where I got burnt, we changed Devil's Night into Angel's Night.
Yeah. Devil's Night being Halloween in Detroit, where there was this awful thing of people starting fires all over the city.
Well, think about this. People were trying to sell their houses because when you don't have 1,800,000 people live in a city and the population was around a million or less than a million people, you had over 800,000 people no longer in the city and no longer needed housing, and people trying to sell houses couldn't sell it. And so there was some arson involved.
Yeah.
And that happened during Mayor Young's administration, but he calmed it down and reduced it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got in the first year, and we assumed incorrectly that there was so much enthusiasm, positive feeling about the future, there would not be this problem again. Well, I got burnt, and it did not happen again. And so we had the volunteers out in huge numbers that also were available to help when issues came up. For example, in one of my years, our schoolgirls being assaulted on the way to school. Well, I went to the religious community. I went to the volunteers who helped with Angel's Night, and they put the yellow lights on top of their cars. I went to the businesses in the city who had trucks like the utility companies and others, taxi cabs, to watch out for our kids. I had parents walking their kids to school, et cetera. And we not only reduced and stopped the schoolgirl assaults, we caught the people that were doing it. And you can't do that without the community.
Yeah.
The community was just fabulous, and they were always looking for ways to try to give back to improve our city. You can't find a more enthusiastic, voluntary group of men and women and children who love their city than we had in the city of Detroit. It was just fabulous.
Dennis Archer's autobiography is called Let the Future Begin. He was interviewed by Zinta A-Stars. A segment of the interview with Dennis Archer originally aired on WMUK's Between the Lines in January. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.